Bristol Community FM.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Britain's gone further down the surveillance road than any state in the world, and there's always money for snooping technology. So despite the recession, Big Brother lurks still at the end of a city-wide CCTV feed, and shoppers are being tracked around Cabot Circus. But when someone's attacked or robbed in front of a camera, "We're sorry, there isn't any film," is the usual reply from the authorities. So at 6:30 we're joined by surveillance expert Tim Jolly, who helped force Birmingham City Council and the police up in Birmingham to remove a CCTV system which had been set up all around a predominantly Muslim residential area. Also, we look at the future of Bristol's transport. Rapid transit is on the cards, but where will it run? And we've been here before, so will it really ever happen? Also, a review of last weekend's Bilderberg Secret Rulers of the Western World conference, and we explain what the BBC didn't tell you that it was even going on, because their man was inside and sworn to secrecy. Now we'll go over to have a chat with Martin Summers and our usual weekly roundup of world events. Martin, is there anything you'd like to bring to our attention this week?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing is what we've been talking about in the first hour, which is the Euro crisis. And, of course, the potential for war in the Middle East. I mean, those are the things that are looming over us as major issues for human society to get a grip with.
OK, what about this? The Middle East? What developments have we had? Because we've had another massacre, haven't we, in Syria?
Yes, and lots of conflicting accounts about who did it and who didn't do it and so on. I think the Western powers are basically looking for a way out of this UN-sponsored peace process. They don't actually want a peace process. I understand the Americans are talking to the Russians, saying, you can have it one way or the other. We're going to remove Assad. You can either cooperate with us in removing Assad, otherwise he's going to go anyway, because we're going to keep up the pressure. We're going to talk about arming the rebels. Mitt Romney, for example, made it clear we're going to arm the rebels. We're going to encourage kind of intervention. I mean, they're basically calling for intervention. So, you know, the situation doesn't look good, because it's very hard to draw back from a conflict like that when both sides are absolutely dug in and refusing to budge.
Well, but politicians and the public will be more enthusiastic about some sort of regime change in Syria, surely, around the Western world, now they've seen these massacres that have taken place.
Yeah, but I mean, most people realise that even if the massacres were carried out by pro-regime elements, and that's disputed by the regime, there are car bombs going off in Damascus and Aleppo. It's quite clear that the Free Syrian Army is an armed insurrection. It's not a peaceful uprising, it's a civil war, and what you've got is a large proportion of the population support the regime, another large proportion of the population don't. All of the minorities are supporting the regime, so the Christian patriarch and the Latin Christian leaders in Damascus are saying that they support the regime. The Kurds generally support the regime, because it's most of these insurgents are Sunnis, and they're being backed by Saudi Arabia and by Qatar and by the Western powers and by the Turks. And the potential for Syria to become Iraq is absolutely there. I mean, the Christian community of Iraq fled to Syria for safety, and now they're not happy about the situation. They think that they're going to go into a situation similar to Iraq, and that the Sunni insurgents from Iraq are infiltrating into Syria, the people that used to be fighting against the Americans now being armed by the Americans to overthrow Assad. So it's a big mess, and I think ordinary people around the world can see it's a big mess. It's not black and white, it's a mess, and of course it's a tragedy for the people who live there.
So what should we be doing about it? Diplomatically,
well,
and militarily.
The obvious thing to do is to support the UN peace plan of Kofi Annan. And Kofi Annan, of course, is the previous UN chief. Ban Ki-moon is seen as far too much in the pocket of the West, basically. Kofi Annan was seen as a more independent character, which is why he was put in to do the peace process. And what he was saying is the insurgents have got a ceasefire and the government has also got a ceasefire. But of course, the West has never been happy with the UN peace plan. They want Assad out, and that's all they're interested in. Now, that, of course, is a recipe for civil war, for sure.
And what about under international law? Are they allowed to say that? We've decided that we want regime change in Syria?
Well, they can say it, and the Syrians are entitled to say, well, no, you're not, because we're not going, because it's unstoppable force meets immovable object. They had a referendum in Syria about a reform process. Now, the West wasn't happy about that. They said it was a farce, there were people being killed, you can't have a referendum under those circumstances. But a majority of the population did participate in that referendum. So the idea that Assad has no support, he's in a very different situation, perhaps, from Gaddafi. Gaddafi probably had a lot less support on the ground than Assad's got. It reminds me an awful lot of what I saw in Bosnia, where everybody thinks they're in the right, and in actual fact, everybody's in the wrong, and it's the poor, ordinary people who get crushed in the middle.
One of the voices we've not heard on this topic, hardly at all on our mainstream media, is Robert Fisk, who's the Middle East correspondent for The Independent. But he did pop up on the English-language Russian channel, Russia Today, a couple of days ago, and he was looking a little bit at the history, because the colonial powers, particularly France, has been very much involved in this area over the years. And that is to say, Lebanon and Syria.
Lebanon is always going through the greatest crisis since the last greatest crisis. And various powers have been trying to destroy Lebanon for 100 years. And oddly enough, even after a 15-year civil war between 1975 and 1990, didn't manage it. I'll tell you one thing. I may be wrong on this, but I hope I'm not. I don't think Lebanese people today want another war. Right. At the time of the civil war, there were various cracks in the social structure of this country, which could be opened up. But you know, during that war, many Lebanese children were sent away to be educated in Rome, Berlin, London, New York, and they've come back and they've said no to sectarianism. And one of the things you do notice among the younger population here is they're not interested in being sectarian. Maybe that is certainly an interest among various groups inside Syria. I would just make one more little historical point. When the French took over the mandate for Syria and then Lebanon, they created a frontier force in Syria called Troupes Speciales, special troops, and they were mostly made up, chosen by the French, of Alawites. And that's how that minority came to be allied originally with an outside power called France.
Well, I mean, that's from the horse's mouth. I hope he's right about Lebanon, because of course they had a terrible civil war there in the 70s and the 80s, and perhaps people have learned their lesson. But what you've actually got, of course, the Hezbollah dominated government in Lebanon and the government of Iraq of Nouri al-Maliki are both pro-Assad. They're both elected governments. Both Iraq and Lebanon are supposedly democratic countries now, and both of their democratically elected governments do not want to see Assad overthrown.
Aren't those governments really more anti-NATO than they are pro-Assad?
Well, the Iraq and Lebanon are somehow in the middle. I mean, basically, the Iraqi government and the Lebanese government, the current Lebanese government is anti-Western. The government in Iraq was put in power by American power and British power. But, of course, they are Shiites like the Alawites. And, of course, the danger is that you could set off a sectarian battle going across the whole Middle East, exactly of the kind that we saw happening in Iraq over the last decade. And, you know, people are scared of that. So a lot of people in Syria, especially in the big cities and the middle class, are supporting the regime because they see the consequences of the regime falling in a disorderly fashion are going straight, without passing go, into an Iraqi maelstrom.
But what essentially Robert Fisk is saying there is a lot of the youngsters in that part of the world are very wise to the idea that NATO and the West wants to actually foment sectarian violence.
I think that's wishful thinking on his behalf, because in actual fact, what's happened in Lebanon is you've got two big blocks of forces, and it's not entirely sectarian, because the Hezbollah and the Shia forces in Lebanon are in alliance with elements within the Christian community, Michel Aoun's people, and they were fighting each other during the civil war. I mean, the civil war in Lebanon was a bit like the civil war in Bosnia. There was a kaleidoscope of forces and they kept changing sides. So I think what you've got, much to the discomfort of the Americans and the Israelis, is that the Hezbollah Christian dominated government is not really happy with what's happening in Syria in terms of attempts to overthrow Assad. But it could easily spread. I mean, a civil war in Syria could easily spread into Iraq and Lebanon, just like that. because of course people live, these borders are artificial, families and communities are spread on both sides of the borders.
Well, we've just heard an extract from Russia Today, the English language Russian programme, but since Ofcom prohibited the English language Iranian channel Press TV from broadcasting here in Britain, citing minor inaccuracies, but forgetting of course that all five UK terrestrial channels transmitted lies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction back in 2003, which led to an illegal invasion, torture, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people and millions of refugees and other war crimes. After the 6 o'clock news every Friday, what we've been doing over the last couple of weeks is playing excerpts from the channel that, for your own good of course, you are not allowed to watch. More from Gordon Duff this week then, the Vietnam veteran and editor of US news site Veterans Today. Here is what he's been saying about Al-Qaeda on the Iranian channel, now banned in Britain, Press TV.
I'd like to see someone ever prove to me that there's ever been an organization named Al-Qaeda. It's an invention of the United States. It's imaginary. Al-Qaeda was created by the CIA, and most Al-Qaeda acts, over 80%, are performed by national intelligence agencies allied with the U.S. There is an Al-Qaeda. There are militants who will fight against U.S. invasion. If you chose, you could call them patriots. They're certainly not terrorists. As far as Osama bin Laden, worked for the CIA for many years. I'm sitting here on my screen with a photograph of him handing a rifle to Zbigniew Brzezinski of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the directors. The CFR is a puppet organization. Their publication, Foreign Policy, is written by low-level discredited academics. It isn't worth reading. There's almost no understanding of international affairs. Everything is economic determinism. War is war for profit. Destabilization is done to continue war because we no longer have the ability to maintain a huge military-industrial complex to oppose the former Soviet Union. And we're even trying to do that now with our missile defense system. Mm-hmm. We're building missile bases in Poland now, supposedly to protect them from attack from Iran. It's difficult not to laugh if this weren't all so sad. But the premises Bremen is using, the premises Obama is using, the basic premises are that international terrorism exists. It has never existed. It was a creation of convenience to morph our military-industrial needs over to a new economy. Mm. And talking about the U.S. being responsible, the U.S. is not ruled by itself anymore, hasn't been. The U.S. doesn't have independent policy. The U.S. Congress functions. The U.S. President functions as a group of thugs under international control. Who is this international control? We all know that the nations of the world work under the domination of a group of financial criminals. This is how the world really works. It's what we really see that happens. There is nothing that goes on in Afghanistan that enhances the security of the United States. All it does is enrich a few people. We have no security issues. If we left Afghanistan today, they would remove Karzai, they would put someone else in office, and they'd go back to killing each other.
There's Gordon Duff there on the Iranian English language channel Press TV, which is now banned in Britain. He was saying some fairly controversial things there, Martin, such as international terrorism doesn't exist. It's a creation of convenience to move us into a new economy.
Well, I mean, I actually tend to agree with a lot of what Gordon Duff says, and I haven't got time here to go into all the detail about the kind of things he talks about. But the magazine he works for, that he's a senior editor for, Veterans Today, is for veterans of the US Armed Forces. And you will find that most of the hard things he's saying there about the military-industrial complex and war being manipulated by financial criminals, Al-Qaeda being essentially a Western intelligence service front, there's lots of senior people who write for Veterans Today who will totally agree with that, including Colonel Sabrosky, S-A-B-R-O-S-K-Y, who used to head up the US Army War College. He totally agrees with that. Basically, we're dealing with an out-of-control rogue state in the United States of America, and lots of people who fought for the United States of America in various wars, and Gordon Duff was put in a wheelchair during Vietnam, they know.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, I'm joined now by Bristol City Council's Executive Member for Transport, Tim Kent, and also BCFM presenter and spokesman for Rail Futures, Steve Satan, as we look at the future of Bristol's transport. Rapid transit's on the cards, but where will it run? And hang on, we've been here before, haven't we, Tim? Will it really ever happen?
Well, building work will begin next year.
Okay, so it will. Yeah. Yes. What exactly is going on at the moment? Is there some sort of public inquiry consultation? Are the public actually views from the public wanted at the moment or not?
There's a public inquiry process going on our application for Transport and Works Act. This is for only a small part of the rapid transit, although it is a crucial part. And we've applied for a Transport and Works Act because it involves guided bus. So there won't necessarily be all of these processes occurring for the whole of the network, although there will be some more consultation and inquiries. So this public inquiry is looking to that particular aspect. And what we're doing is we're presenting our evidence through officers, experts, and we're being cross-examined, and evidence is coming from objectors. And there are objectors there. The only people who can actually speak are people who have previously registered as objectors to the scheme. And they're the ones in. So it's sort of a battle of the two sides, and that's ongoing for about another week or so.
Okay, so where are the plans are for the rapid transit to go from where to where?
Well, there are three rapid transit routes. So the first basically runs from the current park and ride site at Ashton Vale into the city centre and loops back around again. The second one runs from South Bristol, from Hengrove, to that park and ride site. So that's, in a sense, it links in. And the third one then runs from Hengrove all the way into the city centre, and then goes up the M32 and then splits off in the north of Bristol, one heading towards Cribbs Causeway and the other one heading towards the Science Park.
And what are the sorts of objections have people been making? Is this one of those things where it's people looking strategically at the city, thinking that this isn't the right thing to do, or is it more individuals who don't want these things running past their back gardens?
The objectors are sort of a mixed group. Some people are supporters of a tram, I perfectly understand. They wanted a tram, and instead it's a bus, so that's why they're objecting. There's a few people who are objecting on strong environmental grounds, again, normally because they're tram supporters. There's a few others objecting to their local residents and loss of car parking. And there's a few others objecting because of what they see as the negative effects on the harbourside area of the rapid transit route. There's probably not masses of objectors. In reality, it's probably only 20 or 30 people who are now in the full objection process, although we did start off with nearly a couple of hundred objections. Sounds a lot, but it's actually one of the lowest objections ever to a Transport and Works Act.
So is this right for Bristol, from your point of view?
I think it is. And I think what we've got to do is, first, we've got to be pragmatic in this. Hey, I'd love to build a tram. Everyone would love to build a tram. The reality is trams are expensive, and we haven't got to the bottom yet of how we can deliver cost-effective tram schemes in this country. So what Bus Rapid Transit offers us is an affordable solution, which is proven to work, is used across the world. It basically gives you faster, more direct bus routes using better buses. It cuts through a lot of the windy routes that we see, particularly in South Bristol. People in my ward can take an hour to get into the city centre on bus. On rapid transit, they'll be doing it in 30 minutes. That's the big difference for them. So I think it is good. I think the other thing we've got to remember is it's actually only phase one. Phase two is going to be our Greater Bristol Metro. This is our big investment into rail. We're going to bring back railway lines, bring back railway stations, bring on extra trains. We're going to have a 30-minute service or better at every single station. And that's going to integrate with bus rapid transit, which goes to places where trains don't go.
But the obvious objection, surely, is that this is a fudge. It's neither a bus nor a tram. It's a sort of half-and-half affair.
I think that's a fair enough attack. The reality is, if we wanted to go for a tram, we just wouldn't have it. Simple as that. Government were very clear. Apply for a tram, you're going to get no money.
We're also joined by Steve Satan, who's a BCFM presenter, also from Rail Futures. Steve, what are your thoughts about all this?
Well, it's funny you should say that. As I speak right now, I'm probably appearing on Anglia TV, talking about the...
Do they still exist?
They do, actually, yeah. Well, it's ITV East now, probably. But it's talking about the Luton Guided Busway, which is £11 million over budget. The Cambridge Guided Busway is doubled its original budget. So, you know, the idea that these are sort of successful grand schemes is ludicrous, Tim. I'm sorry, they're turkeys. And in particular, the BRT2, the Ashton Vale to Temple Meads, as it's supposedly called, is just such a monstrous, stinking turkey of a scheme that whoever dreamt it up, needs their
own. But aren't you being a bit of a party pooper here? Because what Tim has just explained is that it's this or nothing, actually. The money's not there for a tram. So,
well, in that case, we would be better off with nothing. This scheme is worse than nothing. It will ruin the ambience of the harbour side. It will trash the harbour railway. It will deliver absolutely no benefits in terms of transport. And I don't know why, I don't know why anyone would be daft enough to go for it.
Okay.
But I want to ask Tim about the objectors, because he mentioned the objectors. And I attended a meeting of the objectors at the Hen and Chicken a couple of weeks ago. And there really was real anger at this scheme. So, Tim, will you meet the objectors, or are you going to play chicken?
I've met the objectors on several occasions already. I'm surprised you didn't know that.
Well, would you be happy to attend another meeting? Because the people who were there saying, why aren't the councillors here? Why is no one here to defend this ludicrous scheme? And you weren't there.
Well, I wasn't there because that was a meeting for you to plan out your attack within the public inquiry process. I think it was actually very important, one, I wasn't there to give you a chance to do that. But two, at the same time, I didn't want to reveal the cards we're playing. Quite naturally within the public inquiry.
Hang on, why are you playing cards? I mean, if you have a robust scheme, you shouldn't have to be doing sort of devious tactics of hiding your cards. You should present the case in a very open way and defend it. It sounds like you're.
I mean, that's ultimately
that.
That's what's happening in this public inquiry, Steve. But one of the things I'd really like to drill down into here is you're saying that this is not going to be any good. As a transport solution. Can I just hear from you, Tim? How is it going to help transport in the city? Because, I mean, we're going into this Green Week at the moment. We're trying to appeal to the whole of Europe to say we're a great green city. And yet, actually, transport is our Achilles heel.
Most of the main sustainable transport groups in the city are backing the rapid transit schemes.
Rubbish.
That's not true.
The reality is it will carry about 8 million passenger journeys a year. It will cut congestion. It will cut our carbon emissions. I do accept that it's not as good as a tram, but I think when we go through the list of overspends, I notice you didn't include the Edinburgh tram, only now several hundred million pounds over budget and half a tram route on what was promised. You didn't mention the other BRT schemes, such as the Hampshire scheme, just recently delivered on time, on budget. The reality is...
This BRT is this bus rapid transit.
Bus rapid transit. Yeah. The reality is nearly half of all public transport infrastructure schemes overspend. So anyone can come up with lists of ones that have gone wrong, and anyone can come up with lists of ones that have gone right. What this is a practical solution government would fund. But there's bigger stakes on the cards here. If we fail to deliver this, we'll nearly definitely fail to get the extra money for rail that we've bid for. We must look at this as everything is integrated. So I do put to those people who object to this, they need to be aware, and I accept that they don't like bus rapid transit, but do they really want to take the risk that we'll also potentially lose maybe an extra £100 million of additional funding towards our rail improvements we want to make.
Steve, before we lose this thought, what local groups are actually objecting to this? I mean, we've got a bit of a dispute going here.
Rail Future, Portishead Rail Group, the Transport for Greater Bristol Alliance, Friends of the Earth, there's loads and loads and loads of groups. The idea that the whole of the transport community in Bristol is behind this is just ludicrous.
So, Tim,
in fact, the BRB residuary are one of the objectors.
Tim, would you concede that maybe you haven't done your homework beforehand in actually getting these local groups on board with the scheme?
No, I don't feel that at all. I mean, the reality is a lot of these objectors are objecting because they have pet projects. Nothing wrong with that. Some of those pet projects I strongly support myself. But I think what people need to do is begin to think a bit more out of the box when it comes to transport here in Bristol. We've got big challenges and we need to have big projects to tackle those. Bus rapid transit is just the first phase of several additional projects, a major investment in our transport infrastructure over the next 10-15 years. If we do the standard Bristol thing of ripping it down at the last stage, as we've done before with tram projects, what will happen is government will just wash their hands of us, take the money to another city, and once again we'll be left stuck in our cars swearing about why hasn't someone done something about this.
Steve, he's got a point, hasn't he, there, because this has happened time and time again in the city that things have fallen down at the last hurdle and the schemes haven't gone ahead because of last minute objections. If you could tweak this, I mean, I know you don't like the scheme at all, but if you could tweak it, you know, are there ways you think that the scheme could be tweaked to work?
There's a much simpler way of doing it. It's just to put a bus lane down the Hotwells Road, and you get all the advantages without, at about a tenth of the cost. You know, the Harbour Railway, using the Harbour Railway as a bus lane is such a stupid idea. It will offer no time savings at all. So why do it? Why waste all that money on laying thousands of tons of concrete for no gain? It's so stupid.
And why is this? What's this big objection with the harbour side? Because, I mean, at the moment, you know, it makes sense, surely, to use the old rail lines that still exist there for something like this, and to use that as a way of getting in and out of the city. Why not?
Well, we do at the moment with the Harbour Railway. It's also to do with...
No, hang on. That's an old chuffy steam train. That's not bringing commuters in the morning and taking them home in the evening.
I'll grant you that, but it is an asset to the city. It's a tourist attraction. Now, if you imagine you're sitting by Brunel's Buttery on a lovely sunny day, which is quite hard to imagine, in the sort of weather we got at the moment, imagine someone's plonked two bus lanes right next to you. Do you think that's going to improve the ambience of the harbour? Of course it's not. It's going to drive tourists away. It'll be bad for the city. And so, it's one of the reasons why it's worse than nothing.
So Tim, how do you answer that one? It does sound like you're going to be changing the character of the harbour side at the moment. It's actually quite a nice place to sort of sit and eat your bacon butty or whatever. It's quite a chilled out zone, and some people, of course, have bought flats in this chilled out area.
Well, at that point, we're also going to remove several hundred car journeys an hour. So that's the thing people forget. They talk about the 10 or 20 buses that are going to be going up and down near them, but right next to them on Prince Street Bridge, several hundred car journeys an hour will be removed. So actually the ambience is going to be far, far better. The buses we're going to have are going to be eco buses, they're going to be biomethane, or worse, they're going to be electric hybrids. So they're going to be they're not going to be polluting vehicles. It's going to give people direct links into M-Shed and SS Great Britain, so it'll be far less cars going to those points and car parks, so people can actually make sustainable journeys to these points, simply because we are going to put the public transport right there, right on the harbour side.
I mean, how do you answer that one, Steve? Because that's a great idea, isn't it? Getting tourists to stop at the old park and ride, hop on one of these things and come into the city centre to do their touristy things without bringing their cars. Great.
Well, you know, I like to think that they would, but you know they won't, because the routes on the bus rapid transit are already replacing existing bus lanes. So what we're doing is just diverting existing bus routes. And if the tourists don't use them now, why would they use them if they go to a slightly different side of the city? That doesn't make sense at all.
OK, Tim, can you just explain then for us, how is this likely to all roll out once the public inquiry is over?
Well, the public inquiry will end in the next week or two, and then they'll go off and probably take many months in deliberation. What we're hoping to do is get the green light next year. We should be able to achieve the final funding from government. That will give us the ability to build. And then ultimately, Ash will be able to Temple Meads route opening June 2015, and Hengrove to North Fringe and South Bristol Link 2016-2017.
And it doesn't even go to Temple Meads. This is the joke. It stops a quarter of a mile from Temple Meads. Where's this integrated transport policy if the bus rapid transit can't even link up with the main railway
station? Going to Temple Meads, and also at the same time we will be seeing the Portishead Railway reopen. That's our plan, and we will see also 30-minute journeys on the.
Okay, this is quite a serious point, isn't it, that Steve's making here? Is this new rapid transit bus going to go to Temple Meads or not?
Yes.
How close?
Right next to the door.
Okay. All right. So
well,
anyway,
plan,
anyway, we will wait to see how this all rolls out. Steve, let's just finish with you telling us about your show here on BCFM and also a bit about Rail Futures.
Well, Rail Futures is a campaign group that you know, does what it says on the tin. We're pro rail. Now we're not anti bus, because we recognise that bus has a huge role to play in providing passengers to railway stations, amongst other things, and as a transport form in its own right. But you know, where ludicrous bus schemes come up, such as Cambridge and Luton and Bristol Harbourside, we're going to oppose them because they're stupid.
Tim, I'm going to give you the final word. Where do you think in the city people are going to most benefit from this new scheme?
Well, particularly the south of Bristol, which has very poor public transport links, especially when it comes to speed. This will give them speedy links to the city centre, but also that growth in jobs in the north of the city. And this is a key problem. We've got lots of people living in the south, which are locked out of the jobs in the north. And that's what rapid transit is all about trying to solve.
Monetary reform. Monetary reform. Loose
have rule by banks. Plutocracy. You have rule by banks. Plutocracy. You have rule by banks. The borrower shall be servant to the lender. You have rule by banks. The goldsmiths had discovered that they could control the king by withdrawing their loans of gold money. You have rule by banks. The goldsmiths got used to being able to bully the king by the mere threat of reducing the money supply. You have rule by banks. This is exactly what's going on today. You have rule by banks. When the wealthiest private citizens have control over the money supply, then the government is no longer sovereign. The borrower shall be servant to the lender. You have rule by banks. Government is no longer the supreme power of the land and can no longer operate in the public interest. No stoop.
What kind of a system is this? It's insane. You couldn't design a worse possible system. If you or I did this, we would be charged with fraud. With fraud. With fraud.
The truth of the manipulation of our money supply can no longer be hidden. Break humanity free of the enslaving shackles of the debt money system. Break humanity free of the enslaving shackles of the debt money system.
That was Robin Carvell's mix of Bill Still. He's the US former newspaper manager turned monetary reformer, and some extracts from two of his films there. One film is called The Secret of Oz, which is the more recent one, and the other one is The Money Masters, both of which are available online.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, now to CCTV and surveillance, and I'm joined on the phone by Steve Jolly from Birmingham. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Fine. And now, first of all, you've been involved just today, haven't you, in a bit of action up in Birmingham. Can you just tell us what you've been up to and how it all went?
Yeah, today because today is the anniversary of the publication of George Orwell's 1984. So we've declared today 1984 Action Day, and it's the first of an annual event which will be international. So we've had things going on in Europe, in Germany, Austria and Australia, and next year we hope to have stuff going on in America and other countries too. So it's an interesting time where people are starting to wake up.
When was it actually published, 1984? Wasn't it just after the Second World War?
1949, I think it came out.
Okay. And so, yeah, so what exactly were you up to today?
Well, it was a little stunt, a light-hearted, humorous and polite stunt. So we weren't sort of shouting with megaphones or waving placards or any of that sort of thing. And we were trying to get people just to question and think. So we've got a little stunt offering photography portraits in a sort of gritty urban action style, and we'd say £10 for your photographs. They've already been taken, and a lot of people would sort of turn around and raise an eyebrow and say, what do you mean you've already taken pictures of us? And this can rile people, the suggestion that, you know, you've been filmed without being asked.
That's echoes there, because I can remember back in the 1980s, investigative journalist Duncan Campbell doing a similar sort of exercise with people about data protection in a little tent in a city centre somewhere in Britain, where he was saying, well, come in, and if you just tell us your name, we will tell you all about yourself, what we can gather through various databases which are available publicly. And people were pretty shocked to know that you know, you can actually find out a tremendous amount with these kind of modern databases. So anyway, you know, Britain apparently then is the most advanced, you say anyway, surveillance state in the world. How do you know that?
Well, London is always cited as the CCTV capital of the world, and Britain as, if you like, leading the way in that direction. And unfortunately, other countries are following our model, China particularly so. But we have millions of cameras in this country. Nobody knows the exact number, but what we do know is that that number is always growing.
And one of the things that bothers me is that they're not actually closed circuit anymore, are they?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, they're monitored and stored from a remote location, and the information, the data is sent over the internet. And, you've no idea what's happening with your data once it's been taken. And these monitoring centres are often being run by private companies like Serco, G4S and others. And West Midlands Police in Birmingham, where I am, are currently tendering for privatising some of their police services. And often the surveillance aspect, the CCTV systems, would be one of those things that they would wish to outsource. So we're not even sure who's watching us now and for what reasons. I mean, cameras can be viewed as not as preventing crime, which we know they don't, and I can certainly give you evidence to prove that. But what they do is they turn crime into a monetizable event, so that the courts and the system, if you like, the recompense is money.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we're constantly told, Steve, that those CCTV cameras out there are there preventing crime. So what evidence have you turned up that they're not?
Well, you're right, we are constantly told that, to the point where pretty much everyone believes that, and they will say, well, that's why we have it, because it, you know, stops crime and catches people and keeps you safe, and you know we need it, surely, and it makes me feel safer, a lot of people say. But unfortunately, this is just a message that's been given to us. It's a myth. A myth is something that people believe that's not necessarily true, but people believe it. And the CCTV is just another lie, a long series of lies that we've been sold on. But this one has taken hold particularly well. I mean, the studies done by the Home Office and the police themselves, even, hoping to prove that they could claim that this is really solving crime, have all failed. I mean, Home Office Study 252, Home Office Study 292, the Campbell Collaboration Review, which was intended to be the most definitive study. They said, we're going to look at every study ever done in this country in all sorts of different situations, public transport, shopping, retail, pubs, clubs, wherever the cameras are, you know, street cameras, car parks, and they went through rigorously every scrap of information to try and nail it once and for all. You know, what effect does CCTV cameras have on crime? And their overriding conclusion, the key finding of that most definitive and comprehensive report, was that CCTV had no significant effect on crime.
Well, I must say, my experience, certainly through friends and acquaintances that I've known that have needed CCTV evidence, say, for example, when they've had something stolen in the street, or we had a case on here a couple of weeks ago with Cliff Hanley, who was beaten up and actually permanently, it looks like, disabled in the city centre right in front of CCTV cameras, is that the police often then will then, and the authorities just throw up their hands and say, well, sorry, it wasn't on CCTV.
No. I mean, that's so often the case. But the only way to get around that, if the effectiveness of CCTV is to be believed, is to have a camera watching every square inch, and then surely nothing could be missed.
What you're saying is that the authorities are saying, well, the answer is spend more and have more CCTV.
Yes, when the cameras don't work, they don't do what we're told they do. The answer is always, we need more cameras, which is the most illogical argument you could ever arrive at. If something is proving to fail, do it more, do more of it. It doesn't make sense, does it?
But no, it certainly doesn't. And also, the cameras themselves are getting smarter, aren't they? I mean, we've got high-definition pan, tilt, zoom cameras, analytical software, that's to say biometrics, facial recognition capability, so they can actually match people's faces as they're walking past to massive databases, and also something called behavioural detection. What's that?
Well, for instance, if you're standing in a public place and you're carrying a bag, and perhaps you put that bag down and you walk away to perhaps talk to a friend, say goodbye, that would be classified very, very likely as errant behaviour, as suspicious behaviour. An unintended package could be a bomb, and this could be extended to all sorts of other scenarios, to include running or walking in an erratic manner. You know, the computer decides and learns and teaches itself, we're told, this new analytical software, behavioural analysis, and it learns what is normal and what is outside of the normal. So it's sort of enforcing normality and conformity, not necessarily crime or anything wrong, but just it looks for something that it decides is suspicious. So now you've got a computerized watcher, never mind a man in a uniform but who works for a private company and not the police anymore. You've taken it further away and you've said, well, let's let a computer decide whether your behavior is suspicious. And you know, one of the main problems that I have with CCTV, this is the sort of crux of the message, is that not just that it isn't very effective. That's because otherwise I might be arguing for more effective cameras. It enables an infrastructure of control which would be perfect for more totalitarian systems of government, should we ever have one in the future.
Well, and it seems to be creeping a bit in that direction, doesn't it? Because, as you said, much of this is being paid for by the public, but then owned and operated, and the contracts for that being done by private businesses.
Hello, Steve. It's Martin here. I would just ask, perhaps you could tell our listeners about what happened in the area of Birmingham where your campaign against CCTV cameras was successful, where the Association of Chief Police Officers were acting outside the law, and you showed that they were acting outside the law, talking about totalitarianism and so on.
Well, that's what really caught my attention. A poll went up, a camera post in the area where I live. It just happened to be in a very sort of quiet, leafy residential street. And I thought, well, this is unusual. And turned out that there were hundreds of them. And the reason they were seemed to be in odd locations is because they were forming a sort of ring fence, a digital moat, if you like, to encircle one neighbourhood. And then we discovered another one, so that you couldn't drive in or out without being tracked and recorded. There were ANPR cameras, automatic number plate recognition cameras, that logged the vehicle, every vehicle that went in and out.
These are the funny little cameras on the side of the road that say this is not a CCTV camera. They're kind of blue or green, aren't they?
Usually then they have no signage at all, which itself is illegal, but because it's the police that are doing it, they tend to think that the law doesn't apply to them because they have certain exemptions. If it's in the interests of fighting crime and preventing terrorism, they can say that they're exempt from the law that applies to the rest of us. So the police can put up cameras with no signage and no indication of what they are and what they're doing.
So if the law says, does it then, that each camera has to have some kind of sign on to say whose it is or whatever?
It doesn't say each camera, but it says there must be a sign. So, I mean, you could go to perhaps a leisure centre, and there might be a little sign somewhere in the foyer as you go in. But beyond that, there probably won't be. But there really ought to be adequate signage. But, you know, who's defining adequate signage? But if I'll give you an example. I went to Sainsbury's in Newquay recently, and they had a cafe in there and a customer toilet. And there was a sign outside saying, in the interest of hygiene and customer safety, their regular inspections are carried out and CCTV is in use in this area. And I wondered what area they meant. And I went through two more doors into the actual toilet with a cubicle and three urinals. And sure enough, there was a camera on the ceiling, which was a sort of covert one because it was disguised as a sort of smoke sensor. But that's what was actually happening. There was a camera in the toilets.
But what I was driving at when I asked you the question, Steve, was that these cameras in the area of Birmingham where you were, you discovered that the Association of Chief Police Officers, I believe, had put these cameras up without getting proper permission to put them up there. And that's why you were able to get them removed.
The whole thing was a lie, because when people who live locally said, well, what are these cameras actually for? And you know, why have they been put here? We were told it was just community safety and antisocial behaviour and, you know, protecting vehicles and catching, you know, people who are uninsured and stuff like that. We very quickly discovered that all the funding came from ACPO-TAM, the Association of Chief Police Officers Terrorism and Allied Matters Fund. It was only for terrorism and counter-terrorism purposes. So that was exposed immediately, and then the police were forced to admit that, yes, they never admitted they'd lied, but documents revealed that they had seriously misled our local councillors, and they led them to believe it was about something else, and actually denied it when they were asked, has it got anything to do with preventing violent extremism? And you know, the police totally downplayed that and said it's about lots of things. It would include that because it includes everything. But no, we were told it was for one thing. It was from another. So they started off from on the back foot, having to be defensive. But the campaign against it just hammered them with so much publicity in the national and international media that they were so hugely embarrassed, and it was a PR crisis for them that they had to take them down, all of them, and just scrap the scheme.
Yeah, but they didn't scrap the cameras, did they? I believe that the Metropolitan Police bought them.
That's right. They're now part of the Olympic security operation. And I wonder if they're going to be removed afterwards. Somehow, I doubt it.
Can you tell us then about some of the cutting edge? We've already heard about this old idea of biometrics, which is matching up people's faces using these cameras. And there's also these sort of mobile cameras, aren't they? The ones that are up in drones flying up in the sky.
Well, drones is a massive area of concern, and it's a huge industry that's about to just take over. Cheaply produced remote control planes can be used for launching missiles and rockets, but also for surveillance. So they just have cameras on instead of weapons. And the police in Britain are developing and testing surveillance drones with BAE systems. They're flying out of an airfield in North Wales across the Irish Sea. The South Coast Partnership and Kent Police, working with the Immigration Service, they're also doing tests and working on surveillance drones. But 2 years later, we're still waiting for responses to an freedom of information request. So they don't really like to let you know what it is that they're up to with these things. But it's been estimated that there will be drones over the skies of America very soon, and possibly as many as 30,000 of the things, just covering the entire all the United States.
Well, it sounds to me, I mean, I don't know if you're a fan of the series, but a little bit like The Prisoner, this series from 1968, which was all about a spy in London that tried to resign, but then he was kidnapped and stuck into this village. And the thing I can remember about that is that on every corner, it was the first time, I suppose, this had been introduced to the British public, to the viewing public, and it was only a drama series. But there seems to be a little bit of a prophetic angle to that, doesn't there? That now we do have, in many of our cities, at least in the city centres, a camera on every corner watching us, rather like The Prisoner was being watched back in the 1960s in this drama.
Yeah, a lot of these works do seem to be very prescient, and I'd definitely say George Orwell's 1984 imagined a vision. Orwell himself said that this is not necessarily what will happen, but something resembling this could happen when, in the minds of men, more totalitarian systems of control are thought of by the state.
But what can we actually do about it, Steve? Because this is all a little bit depressing, isn't it, when we think of the idea of some sort of computer watching us wherever we go, you know, if we're in the city centre and having to sort of hide behind a bush if we want any kind of privacy whatsoever. What can we actually do? I mean, I'm asking you because you have managed to achieve so much in Birmingham in getting this whole fraudulent system, which was brought about by the Association of Chief Police Officers, actually lying to your local politicians. You've got that closed down.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a huge story. The media played a part because it was a scandal, and there were very serious questions. And by exposing that, that was just, it was a lot easier to get something done. But I'm only one person. But if everyone did something very, very easy, we'd stop it overnight. And all you have to do is change your mind. Stop supporting it. Even if you don't think about it or don't comment on it, if you do nothing and say nothing, it's assumed that you support it. And if you stop people in the street and ask them, most of them say they support it. And what we have to do is to change people's minds. And this is the purpose of the stunt, just to bring back to the beginning. The purpose of the stunt we did today in Birmingham was to challenge people's perceptions about privacy and surveillance and the messages that they've absorbed and taken in and bought into the myths, and just step back a little bit and re-examine those and get people to think. So we can plant the seeds of of questioning, to get people to question their faulty assumptions about whether or not there's danger in a mass surveillance society. And if we can do that, then people will start to change their minds as they look into it a little bit more. I looked into it and started researching it after something happened on my doorstep in Birmingham. It doesn't take something huge like that. All you have to do, really, is to be willing to think about it, look at things from a slightly different perspective, take in new information, and stop supporting it. So go to your local council meetings, and if they're proposing to put cameras in your high street or somewhere, tell them why you're against it. And if more people did that, these local schemes, because often it's just your local councillor who thinks he's doing good, and you know the community tends to usually agree, and that's how it spreads. You know, it could just take one person and a couple of other people have a little meeting, and then turn up at one of these council meetings and say, actually, no, we're not in favour, and here's why.
Well, one of the reasons for that, of course, is what we have so much in our society is where something starts off as a wonderful public project, but then it's all privatised and it's in the hands of private businesses. Martin, I mean, I have a sort of sixth sense that tells me this is not the sort of thing that should be in the hands of private companies. I mean, for example, the London Underground. We know just before the 7/7 London bombings, that CCTV system, surveillance system in the London Underground, was taken away from Transport for London and given to a private company. Not only that, actually a foreign-owned Israeli private company. So, I mean,
Verint
what is
systems?
Verint systems. The dangers of private ownership of these public space CCTV networks. Can you just talk about that?
Well, I think ultimately CCTV could be used for good if it's used in a moderate way, but like all things that are interfering with people's privacy, there's got to be checks, balances and controls, hasn't there? It can't just be the default thing that we do. If we're going to put stuff up, we've got to know who put it up, why it's there, where does the footage go, and all the rest of it. Because you know, you can't presume that the people at the other end of the camera have got your best interests at heart, can you?
Steve, finally, you also point out that some of the social networking sites, they are also keeping us under surveillance too. I mean, what do you know about that?
Well, I mean, it's called Facebook, and one of the things about it is photographs, but also everything you write. But I've spoken in other interviews about the facial recognition technology, which would presumably require a database of every face. And there it is. It's called Facebook. It's the book of faces. And all this information doesn't even belong to us once you put it on there. It belongs to someone else. It belongs to a private company. It's now theirs.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is that the police have bought a massive piece of software. I remember seeing this about 8 months ago, which is can be used right across the country, which actually constantly in real time tracks people's activity on these sites and feeds a sort of database of your social networks to the police, so they can see if they're suspicious about one particular person, who your friends might be, and say, for example, you disappear, whose house you might be round, that kind of thing. So, but this is all happening in real time. So when you're tapping into your Facebook page, you're also tapping into this computer system controlled by the police.
Yeah, that's really quite worrying, because you know, it really sort of signals the end of privacy. The government is announcing that it wants to store and monitor everyone's emails and phone calls and text messages and everything they do online, everything they search for. And really what that suggests is that everyone's a suspect. So we've been turned from citizens into suspects. So we're now presumed to be guilty until we prove ourselves innocent.
Well, Steve, whereabouts can people go to sort of, and what groups are campaigning on this broader issue, and where can they go to find some of your work up online?
Come and find us at No CCTV. That's the campaign group nationally and now internationally. That's no-cctv.org.uk. And you know, there are other groups like Big Brother Watch who look at they focus on the sort of the parliamentary goings on, look at what the legislation's up to. And I gave evidence to one of these parliamentary committees about the new code of practice for CCTV, which I pointed out was more of an enabling act. It just sort of said, let's have more of it, and how can we do it better? There was nothing in there about protection from surveillance, unfortunately. So, you know, people really need to start realising that where this could be heading. And the phrase that's used to sell it to us is that if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. But that same phrase also happens to be the favourite phrase of dictators and totalitarian governments. And in fact, China has just praised Britain on its revised attitude towards internet censorship and says, well, now we can work with you, now that you realise the internet is a big spy machine and you're happy to have similar sorts of policies to our regime, then the Chinese are praising us in Britain. So, but people need to be aware, not to fall for this argument that if you've got nothing to hide and you should allow your life to be investigated. You know, there's a reason why we have privacy, why we wear clothes, why we have curtains, why we keep our PIN numbers a secret. It's a fallacy to suggest that you must be under constant scrutiny, otherwise you're a criminal. And that is the mark of a more fascistic or totalitarian government. And I, for one, certainly believe we're heading towards that direction. And we need more and more people to wake up and start questioning and challenging.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way with Steve Jolly there, because Friday night is music night, 2 hours with Pat Hart and his Fresh Blood Party crew, and just in Studio 2, limbering up, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Also to Tim Kent, Lib Dem Councillor, and to Steve Satan from Rail Futures. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, the McNulty report into the railways is recommending that the privatised train operating companies should be able to charge what they want, meaning fares will go through the roof, or good news for the oil companies, but what will it mean for the rest of us? Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. We'll do a review of the Bilderberg conference next week. We didn't have time for that this week, and a podcast for this show is online 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Dazza is a looter in trainers and a hood. He trashed his local corner shop. He'd learned that greed is good. The CCTV nailed him. The papers called him scum. Now Dazza's in the barry place, crying for his mum. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Dazza is a looter in pinstripes, brogues and tie. Short selling in the city, he made millions on the sly. He nicked our hard-earned savings, then turned round and said thanks. He walked off with the money, and we bailed out the banks. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Creed to creed, the breeds and breeds, what else can you expect? The selfish scum get richer and communities get wrecked. Some rob us with an iron bar, some a computer screen. And when they say it's legal, that's even more obscene. Dazza is a street kid, and what he did was wrong. But he probably wouldn't do it if he felt he could belong. Bazza's rich and privileged, he doesn't give a ish. He takes us for a load of mugs and gets away with it. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Make sure you wear a suit. Make sure you wear a suit.